Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
It would have been stupid for me not to work with him. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you. Where you think the cipher come from? The gods. Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 246, a talk with Kay Salam. Kay Salam is a producer and DJ who, both by himself and with his production partner Beatnik, has made beats for some of your favorite artists. A short, by no means complete list includes Nas, Freddie Gibbs, Talib Kweli, Trey Songz, Lil Wayne, Murs, Bun B, Sizzler, and Young Buck. Kay Salam got his start in Minneapolis, where he was an integral part of the early years of the Rhymesayers label. He DJed for many of the label's acts, as well as for their signature radio show. In recent years, he and Beatnik also worked extensively with Ms. Lauryn Hill, and even had one of their tracks featured in the 2016 Summer Olympics. I caught up with Kay Salam in New York City, where he spent the summer teaching at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU. While you're listening to this episode, head over to thecyphershow.com to check out show notes, playlists, and our archives. When you're done with this episode, you might want to listen to our introductory interview with Kay Salam on episode 241 during the first part of our Soundset special. Also, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future shows. Now's a good time to remind you that the best thing you can do to support us is head over to patreon.com/thecyphershow and throw us a few bucks. We spend a ton of time working on the show each week, and those donations really help us to keep it sustainable. Which is worth more, the cipher or some goddamn avocado toast? And now, here's the man who shows you that real DJs do real things, Kay Salam.
Here with Kay Salam.
That's right.
For the full sit down. Thank you so much for joining us in Minnesota.
Thanks. Oh, yeah, yeah. Thanks for having me, man. That was fun.
What have you been up to since the festival? Let's start there.
I came here to teach my music production class at Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU, Tisch NYU. The title of the class is The Virtual Producer, and that's the main reason I came here. But since I've been here, I've been doing a lot of other stuff, too, but... But yeah, that's the reason I came out here.
How is Clive Davis so far this year?
The class?
Yeah.
The class was dope. Students were awesome. I want to, big thanks to Druha, Leroy Benrose from Noisy Cricket, and Neil Diamond and Stephen Chin from VP Records. They came the last day to give some feedback to the students, and also the final project was a beat that the students made. And they came there to kind of give their feedback from A&R and like record label point of view, which was dope. And the students really liked it.
Druha lectured the class, or he was there to judge?
Druha Friedman is the co-founder of Duck Down Music and is also the GM of Cinematic Music Group.
No, he was there. It's not even necessarily judging this. We just, each student plays the track and he gives, we all kind of give feedback when we feel like it. And also give some words of advice, you know?
I should note that Druha was arranged actually at Soundset, the Druha appearance in your class.
Yeah, we saw him. You said, hey, Druha's here. And then, it kind of was, yeah.
Amazing. I wanted to take it all the way back, even a full generation. Your mother was a piano player, right?
Yeah, she was.
And how serious about it was she?
Before I was born, even after I was born, but she's from a small town in northern Minnesota. She, moved to Minneapolis specifically to have a career as a professional musician, piano player. So she was pretty serious. She was a composer, but more so she would play compositions that were already written, but she was like a virtuoso player. She played a lot of Scott Joplin and she could kill it. She was really good.
Nice. And so I assume there was always a piano around the house. Was that your first instrument?
Actually, yeah, it was. It was. She tried to give me lessons. I didn't like piano lessons. So she instead we wrote music actually, which is kind of like some of the blueprint for what I would have been doing now. So like structuring songs and writing songs, making beats, kind of like it's kind of one and the same. So yeah, that was kind of my beginnings as a producer.
So how did DJing enter the picture for you?
DJing entered the picture when I was in high school, and there was a couple kids there that was DJing, you know, different ethnicities and everything. And a lot of them, I felt like I knew a lot about hip hop, and I just, part of it was I wanted to be cooler than them. And also part of it was, I was honestly amazed by like the blending, and there wasn't too much scratching at that time when I first started, as far as the people I was around, but like the blending of songs together, and hip hop was kind of making a comeback, at least in Minneapolis. You know, at that time, there was like this radio show called Strictly Butter. DJ by the name of Stage One had that show. It was on a small radio station.
Stage One got flavor, though. Stage one got flavor. Right,
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Right. Stage, you on the mic,
stage
baby?
One.
Right up. Hey, yo, Stage.
Oh, I'm in here.
What you gonna give him on the
And he would play, you know, everything from Mobb Deep to, what was some underground stuff? The East Flatbush Project. Of people, you know who that is?
Yeah.
You play stuff like that, like real underground stuff. The Nonce, that was a huge underground group that I was into. A lot of Hyro, and I just like gravitated to that. Black Moon, definitely. And I just I gravitated to it, and I had to do it. I wasn't really doing all that much with my life, too, to be honest. So I needed something to, and I was smoking a lot of weed. Which is not necessarily a bad thing, but I mean, at that time for me,
high school for a lot of people.
Yeah. But at that time for me, after high school, my basketball dreams were kind of like crushed, and like I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I was really smoking a lot of weed. So I was like, well, at least if I'm smoking, I can do this on the turntables and it'll keep me occupied for now until I figure out what I got to do.
Oh, so basketball dreams. So you were pretty serious about that?
I was a serious basketball player. Yeah. Yeah. I was real serious about it. I used to practice all the time.
Wow. What position did you play?
I mean, I was point guard. I knew that I was, you know, if you want to be in the NBA, I was six. Now I'm 6'2.5". At the time, I was 6'1". Even 6'2.5", like in the NBA, you got to be a point guard.
Yeah. Know? And so what happened?
I just, to be honest, I didn't have the athleticism. And I tried out. I had a couple schools looking at me, but not really. My final year in high school it just didn't go that well. I decided to go to community college. There's a community college where I live called Normandale, and a lot of dope basketball players from, especially around the Midwest, which is kind of where the best basketball players come from. You can come from anywhere, but like Chicago, Detroit is, you know, has always been known, especially Chicago is a big basketball city. So a lot of people from the Midwest area who were like really good, but they didn't get their grades up, they would go to that community college. So I figured I'd go there and just, you know, dominate community college, go back to D1. And I got cut from the team. It was unfair. I shouldn't have got cut, but I did. And at the time, I didn't necessarily think it was unfair. I just thought I wasn't good enough. And that was it. But truth be told, I wasn't athletic enough to be in the NBA, you know.
Well, not to rehash old grudges, but what was unfair about it?
I mean, I just should have made, everyone was like, how did you not make the team? Like, I was shooting NBA threes. I had like NBA range. That was my thing. And I could dribble. Like, I was killing it in tryouts, you know, and what, I don't know. I don't know why they didn't pick me, but.
Do you still play ever?
I did. I played actually when I moved to Brooklyn, because I stopped for a while. Because I took it so seriously, and I started again playing in Brooklyn, and then I started taking it too seriously again, and I realized, I was like, okay, I'm going to wake up tomorrow at 9 a.m., I'm going to do 100 crossovers, and then I was like, "Why? What am I doing?
For a pickup game.
Yeah, I was just like, well, I'm not getting paid for this, like, you're a musician, you're a producer, like, put that energy into production, which I do. I was like, you know, so I stopped. I don't play anymore. I still work out. I box and I bike a lot, and I definitely watch, but I can't play because I just take it too seriously. I'm too competitive.
You know, to take it back to post high school, you're DJing, you're blending. When do you really decide, hey, I'm going to dig into turntablism?
It happened just as part of the competition of Minneapolis. I was blending, and the DJs who could scratch were getting more respect, they're getting more love, and it was really dope, and it was very challenging. Like, I remember when I first saw a couple of people scratching, and I was just like, and I tried, I was like, well, how are they doing that? And I remember one of my friends was just like, you just gotta try one thing and do it again and again and again until you get it perfect. And I realized this is really hard. This is extremely difficult art form. I played the trumpet when I was younger. It was my second instrument. Mm. And I could, you know, obviously to be great at anything, any art is equally as difficult. But I will say that scratching was harder than playing the trumpet, because it's like, to get it sounding good, you really had to practice well, a lot.
Who were people in Minneapolis at that time who were great, scratchers great at turntablism?
Well, definitely the OG out there was named person by the name of DJ King IXL. He was like the first dude in Minneapolis. He never really got the respect he deserved. He used to drive down to Chicago and win battles, and he would drive down to New York, and he won a lot of battles. Even the battles he lost, I've seen the videos. He showed them to me. He should have won, but because I don't know why. I remember he lost to DJ Honda, and he killed DJ Honda. No disrespect, but that was the dude who I first saw scratching, and I was just it was just like. Almost had like a visual, like had like a hallucination almost, you know, like it just was so dope to me. And then there was another dude named Excalibur, who's not around anymore. I don't think either of those dudes are around, like really trying to do it. I think they just do it for the love. And then there's a dude named DJ Abilities. He's still doing his thing. He's still with Rhymesayers. There's Idea and Abilities. After Idea passed, I feel like Abilities just kind of didn't care as much about being famous, just doing it for the love. He's still doing his thing. And he's a dope scratcher.
Gregory DJ Abilities Kelkin was, of course, a founding member of the duo Idea and Abilities with the late Michael Idea Larson. He also performed with I Self Divine and Atmosphere. He is recognized as a great battle DJ and won both of the 1999 and 2001 DMC Regional Championships. And yes, he's a dope scratcher.
So were you like DJing at clubs at that time? I know you were you started DJing on the radio at some point. How did that all happen?
Yeah, well, what happened was I was DJing in my basement, and I really did not want to DJ out until I got good. And then when I did get good, I was DJing out, and I didn't feel like I was getting the respect I deserved. So I had I battled someone, and everybody saw that I was dope. Like, I still have that battle on tape. And
who was that with?
That was with a dude named DJ Fu Manchu, who last time I saw him, he lived in Atlanta, and he was part of, actually, I didn't know this until I saw him, but he's part of DJ Drama's like in-house production crew, which was pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm happy for him. He's a cool dude. Those were in the days where like it could have got physical. I wasn't really planning to take it there, but I remember people were telling me like Fu Manchu and his people are looking for you, like you beat him, and they're not happy about it, and nothing happened. So
you beat him at the battle. He started to get respect, and what happens then?
I beat him at the battle, and immediately, like, Rhymesayers reach out. There's an artist from Rhymesayers, especially by the name of Musab, said, "You want to be my DJ?" And I was like, "Yeah." So then I was like doing all the big shows with Musab. I'm a sentimental, I think it's a decent season. You niggas to grab the microphone and try to be me. Be a patriot. Use your own tools to create your shit. Niggas be biting other styles. And then, you know, the head of Rhymesayers, Sadiq, was just like, "Well, why don't you DJ in between?" And I would DJ for Rhymesayers and with Abilities. And sometimes there'd be other DJs too, but I was like, you know, one of the people holding it down. Just naturally, they had a radio show, like it made sense for me to do it. Yeah.
To the break of dawn. K-Salam was a DJ on the program To the Break of Dawn, which later changed its name to RSE Radio. The program, which was on community radio station 90.3 KFAI, was hosted by the co-founder and current CEO of Rhymesayers, Brent Sadiq Sayers.
Whenever there's shows, either I was doing it or DJ Abilities was doing it, and Abilities was going on tour at the time, so somebody needed to kind of hold it down more so at the home front. So that's how it happened, to be honest with you.
Wow. And so what was it like seeing Rhymesayers grow in that period? So what we're talking kind of like late 90s, early 2000s at this point?
Yeah. To me, it was just, I was growing too. So it was kind of like natural. They were working hard. I was working hard. So it was like, I was really, 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 really hungry at that time. There's a lot of great competition in Minneapolis. I had that huge vehicle, which was Rhymesayers. But there was also, in general, a big hip-hop scene there. And there was a lot of other cool stuff going on as well that was kind of pushing them to always step their game up. There's this show where I had the battle at. It was Bon Appetit called Headspin. It was like a big hip-hop show, weekly thing in Minneapolis. a lot of groups performed there. Some sucked, some were amazing, but it was like that helped develop the scene as well. Yeah, it was dope watching them. I've gotten, I don't want to get off topic, but I've been lucky enough to watch them. And then when I went to Brazil, this hip hop label, Lab Phantasma, they were like, I kind of saw them do the same thing Rhymesayers did, like being the independent people who kind of came up on their own. And I was able to give them some words of advice from stuff that I've seen, you know?
That's awesome. And the radio show you did was pretty well known, according to people we know who have lived there, for its freestyle sessions.
I still come through, don't ever fall back, beat you down with the baseball bat. Not really, I play a game of silly baseball, yeah, from here out to Philly. Yo, you knew me.
Freestyle sessions, not just that, though. Like, people were messing with the radio show. But yeah, we had freestyle sessions. We had everyone who would come into town was on the show, LP and... Oh man, you know, Hyro, anybody, all the big hip hop artists they'd come, they'd perform with Rhymesayers, then they'd come on the show. Definitely.
And what about mixtapes? Because at a certain point, you start releasing your own mixtapes, right?
Yeah. So I was working with them, and then we had a little bit of fallout, which is normal. That happens in this music game. So and during that time that I had that fallout, you know, I was like, well, I'm just gonna kind of stay to myself and work on this mixtape. And I put out a mixtape called Hands of Time, mix CD. I was putting out mixtapes way before that battle, anyways. With a couple of my friends, a person by the name of DJ Francisco, DJ Mashout were two people, and DJ Andrew. These are all people that I used to just DJ with and put out mixtapes with. But that after I won that battle and after I was with Rhymesayers and then left, I had that Hands of Time mix CD, which did a lot in Minneapolis and in underground hip hop in general. I remember that really did a lot. Then I started working with them again, and I put a second one out called Real DJs Do Real Things. Which is something that DJs say nowadays. I made that up. I'm taking credit for that. I made a mixtape called Real DJs Do Real Things. And it was kind of like just a way of saying, if you're a real DJ, you can scratch, you know. It's all good, though. I'm not hating on anyone. But I still kind of feel that as far as if you're a hip-hop DJ. But, you know, at the same time, I know that people don't like that. But it's nothing personal.
Yeah. So these were mixes of pre-release songs, remixes, stuff you would put together?
Yeah, these weren't production-based stuff. These were songs that were already out, and I would just put them together in a way that was dope. Like, structured well, nice blends, and then definitely the scratches in between were really what stood out. The intros were always really dope. You know, I learned a lot from listening to DJ Rectangle and other mixtape DJs at the time who were turntableists. DJ Rectangle was a huge influence on mixtape wise. He's super underrated in hip hop in general. His mixtapes were fire. If I listen to him now, I don't know if you listened, but
I don't know him. No.
Oh, word. Yeah. Yeah. You can go on YouTube and check some of his older stuff. Yeah, like we were all the whole everybody I knew was listening to those mixtapes and they were fire. I guess mad wreck when wreck is the concept. Laying in the sunshine with only one nine. Take 10 paces. Beware. No crew is fading us. I hit 10 degrees at any angle.
Throwing up the west. What's up? Who wanna take? All right. I don't lie. Around that same period, especially with Real DJs Do Real Things, there was a lot of political content, particularly kind of around Palestine on that project, right?
Real DJs Do Real Things came with liner notes that talked about the plight of the Palestinian people. In part, it reads, "Now is the time for us to stand up. No longer can we turn a blind eye to what is going on in Palestine and the rest of the Middle East. Hip-hop is my outlet, and I have taken this opportunity to try to spread some truth and knowledge."
What was behind trying to put that out?
Well, I mean, after the September 11th thing happened, to be honest, I was kind of like, there was a little traumatized. To be honest, I'm a sensitive person. I guess if you're an artist, you kind of have to be. And you know, being my family is Iranian, Even though we're mixed, you know, I'm my dad's side is Iranian, my mom's side is Croatian, but white Minnesotan, you know what I mean? But I feel like going through all that and seeing what happened in Palestine on TV, honest, was like, even though the way it was framed was like, look at these evil people, but I knew what time it was. And anyone who really knows history about
you're referring to the false rumor about people celebrating the Twin Towers
falling. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack.
Following the September 11th attacks, there are a number of false reports and rumors about Muslims celebrating in different places in the U.S., everywhere from a Dunkin' Donuts to New Jersey rooftops. All of these, including ones repeated by Donald Trump as recently as 2015, are false. There were a small number of Palestinians who did celebrate in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, but that happened in East Jerusalem.
In general,
the overall narrative, and not just Palestine, in the United States with John Wayne, and the overall narrative is always the indigenous people are the ones who are the bad guys. They're right. The colonizers are just minding their business, and the indigenous people like hijack them, and whether they're scalping them and stealing their babies, which happened.
Bounties for native scalps were being offered in the colonies as early as the 1630s, and the practice continued well into the 19th century.
You know what I mean? Or whether they're doing other things that were going on in Palestine. I don't believe in violence. I'm anti-violence. But still, I'm anti-violence on both sides, not just the side that's being called, not just to the colonizer. I'm trying to think of the good word here, but yeah, you know, so I wrote something and, it was what it was. I don't know if it helped or hurt anything. I do believe that it opened people's eyes, but I will say since then I've fallen back musically talking about political stuff. Cause I feel like it hasn't really done anything for the cause. I feel like when I do political stuff musically, it doesn't really help the cause. And it's not, so it's like, if it's not helping the cause, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's then what's the point of doing it? So I try to just speak out on my social media, but when it comes to music, just make music. But I kind of went off topic on that. But I wrote that, and
it's actually fascinating. And but you know, even during the period where you and Beatnik started making albums, a lot of it was rap that was politically engaged.
Yeah, it was. And it didn't do that much. It really didn't, you know. And what did make moves was the other stuff that we were just, getting our beats to different people, and all the big songs that we've done with like a lot of views on YouTube or stuff we made. None of it was political. And I don't believe that people don't like political hip hop. I don't believe that. I just believe that sometimes you got to get in where you fit in. You know, I wanted to work with. There were certain artists I think Beatnik was kind of down with it too, you know. He was a little indifferent as far as what direction, but I really wanted to work with Dead Prez, and I ended up working with Dead Prez very much.
Oh, my fallen soldier. Yeah. Whoa, whoa. My little homie Marcus, he was a trusted soldier, had the whole world on his
but I wanted to produce an album with them. I wanted to produce for like Immortal Technique, wanted to produce for Mos Def and this and that. And for the most part, the majority of stuff that we got love from wasn't that. It was whatever, just random people. And then I realized, okay, you can't, you got to go with the people who are vibing with you. I remember G-Unit was feeling us, and I wasn't going to be like, no.
Yeah, I'm saying. Hey, yo, I like to welcome all you motherfuckers to my, come on.
I got my mind and my money right, ready for,
you know what I'm saying? So
right.
Things kind of took its own turn and we moved with it, and it is what it is. I do feel a slight bitterness because I feel like whenever we put stuff out, I never have ever gotten any support from like the political community ever. Very rarely. And I feel like that it's not just me, just in general. I feel like we need to kind of support these artists. And then when people are putting out their trap records, they'll whine and say, we need to put out this music. It's like, well, when we put out that music, you don't support it. So I kind of went off topic, man.
No, I it's great. And in fact, that kind of gets into Whose World Is This? That album, which is super interesting because
thanks,
most of it, like you said, is political, but it's at this kind of intersection of reggae, a lot of which is, by its nature, political and anti-establishment and so forth, mm-hmm. Like especially with its ties to Rastafarianism.
Oh Lord, what is the meaning of life?
If I ain't got a voice and I ain't got a choice and I can't complain.
And then politically engaged rap.
Talent quality. Yeah, I'll let you know. Black man ain't allowed no moments of weakness. The crew ain't got no room for those who flee with the beef. Cause they don't want no beef like people.
Sort of like at the crossroads of those two things.
Yeah, you know, that, thank you. That album, I do get people in the industry who like really are just real music heads, and they'll tell me like that album was groundbreaking. But to be honest with you, that album didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, from like a business point of view as a producer, we did make a lot of money. Like we got signed to a label to a 6-figure deal, mm-hmm. Which was unheard of at that time for like an unknown production team, because we didn't really have any placements at that time. But I do feel like we could have, you know, it just label politics at the time. The person who signed us got a different job and he had to leave. And the new person, the lady who took over the, you know, was kind of taking over the label with the projects, she wasn't feeling us. And because of that, it didn't get any promotion. And, you know, it is what it is. And that's life. But certain things took on a life of themselves, of their own. We put out a single with the instrumental on it. A single with Mos Def and SZA.
Just time you move. The rest is history. I've got the victory.
Stay low, stay fly. High score, point the ball like my name was AI.
That single didn't really do that much either for whatever reason. I thought it was fire, but the instrumental took off and like everyone started recording over the instrumental, and we made a lot of connections with a lot of people through that.
Yeah. And so to take it kind of back to the beginning of you and Nick's partnership, mm-hmm. How did you guys meet?
He gave me a beat CD, and I met him through actually Sadiq at Rhymesayers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why work with him? Like, how? What was? Why did you know you had to work with this guy?
Well, he's on it. To be honest, I'm biased, but I really feel like he's the most talented person I've ever met. He's on another level. He plays every instrument. He can go off on the bass, the guitar, the keys, the drums. He's a dope producer, dope engineer, dope songwriter. The way he puts chords together, he can mix things. He's just like naturally made to be a music producer. And he comes from a long line on both sides. His family's Albanian and then German. And on both sides in the United States, all the way back to like Europe, he has composers on both sides, which is dope. But yeah, it would have been stupid for me not to work with him. At the time, I was an MPC producer. I knew about chords from when I used to play with my mom, play piano with my mom and whatnot.
Right, right.
But I didn't really incorporate them into, I didn't really think about it. I was making drum tracks and I was chopping up samples and they were dope. But he came along, was like, nah, okay, here's how to really make it dope. Let's add this bass line. Let's change the chord here. We can actually change the sample, we can transpose the sample to make it a different note and this and that. And so he actually taught me a lot. Even though he's 10 years younger than me, he taught me a lot about music production. And there was a time when maybe I should let you, you might be asking, do you want me to just keep going?
No, keep going, please.
Well, there was a time when, you know, we tried to get different managers. We tried really hard. We're making tracks together. And so I said, you know, fuck it, man. I'll be the manager. Let me be the man. So I went out, and there was a period where I wasn't really touching the tracks at all. And Nick was just doing the tracks, and I was the one hustling and putting things together and getting placements and whatnot. And I kind of want to move towards that again. Not with Nick, because he's doing his own thing. He's making music for commercials full time. He's doing what he loves. He really wanted to do was make a living through making music, however he does it. But now I'm in the situation where I have so many talented producers coming through my classes, and I'm thinking about, you know, okay, I could actually link these producers with these artists and labels and be the middleman. And I'm kind of thinking about doing that. You know what I mean? I guess things go in cycles for me, like turntablism to producer, to manager, mm-hmm. back to producer. Now I'm a teacher. And I see myself kind of going back in that role, because I do like being social and whatnot. When I used to make beats with Beatnik, we were together. When he moved back to Minneapolis from Brooklyn, I started getting really lonely and like kind of seeing a little change in my life from isolating myself. Because when you produce by yourself, if you're really a producer, you're spending 8-10 hours making tracks a day. If you're really about that life, you really want to make dope music, that's what you're going to do. And I don't know, sometimes it's not the, depending on the what type of person you are, it's not always the healthiest lifestyle.
Sure, I can imagine.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. When you and Nick, early on in your partnership, before you were handling more of the publicity stuff, when you're making music together, mm-hmm. you know, before, when you guys say maybe first moved to Brooklyn together or whatever, and you're uh-huh. working, you're in the same room, mm-hmm. how would you divvy up responsibility? Who would handle what in terms of the music?
It depended on every track, but even then I gave, Beatnik would get the last say, musically. Mm-hmm. He would get the last say. And when it came to how we would push it and whatnot, I would get the last say on that. That's just how we did it. And we never, it's crazy that we lived in Queens, for what, 8, 9 years, something like that, 8 years. And then we lived in Brooklyn for 4 years, something like that. We never, you know, it was close quarters as we lived. We never got in a fight once, which is crazy.
Yeah, that is wild.
Yeah.
So what was behind the idea of doing all the remixes? That you did a Common remix project.
I stagger in the gathering, possessed by a pattern that be scattering. Over the global, my vocals be traveling, unraveling. My abdomen is slime, is babbling. Dramatic set of masculine, I grabbed the...
You did a Motown-ish...
Just to get promotion, just to get publicity. You know, it was weird. That Common remix project, actually, a lot of artists reached out to us and we got a lot of placements. Common never did, which is, I mean, he's not obligated to reach out to us, mm-hmm. not like personal, but it was just weird. So the artists reached out to us who you know, were bigger than him and based off the remix.
Wow. Yeah. But, I mean, it's a really good project.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Thanks. And a lot of that was Beatnik, to keep it real. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we're partners. So there's always, you know, whether it was, whatever the case, but yeah, a lot of that was Beatnik. But I don't know, as much as it did and definitely did, I do, and I know this sounds like very arrogant, but I don't feel like we ever really got the respect that we deserve. But I'm not saying that really to whine or complain, because we're making a living off of music. I'm happy. It's just frustrating seeing like these producers come out and they're literally taking 8-bar loops with no drums, and like we were doing this groundbreaking stuff, and sometimes the music industry is frustrating, and like a lot of the bloggers, not all, obviously some of y'all are mad cool, just like writing about such and such the new, and it's like you don't even know what you're talking about. Yeah, that's so, why I mess with you, Sean, because you actually know your shit.
Well, thank you. So tell me about that, because like one of the things I've noticed in the producing world now is there will be a class of producers, some of whom we've had on the show, who will make music specifically kind of so other producers, hopefully name producers, can add drums to it and use it in a beat.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They'll add like do little, you know, short compositions with the intention of, you know, other people taking them.
Oh, and making them sample royalty free.
Yeah.
And then hoping, oh yeah, yeah. Okay. What are my thoughts on that?
Yeah.
I think that's dope. I like that. There's nothing wrong with sampling. Like I love sampling. There's nothing wrong with sampling. There's nothing wrong with, I just don't like taking a song like that, especially that another producer has already sampled, you know, doing stuff that was done in like the late 80s, early 90s, where you're just literally looping a 4-bar song. There's always going to be place for that. But like, if that's what you're building it off of, it's all good. I'm not knocking anyone, but I don't put that at the level of what we're doing. Like,
well, you guys are composing basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's different, you know what I mean? Like it's in I'm a full believer of like what happened in the past is in the past, you know. I don't like knocking people, but like this 2018, let's try to get the new stuff going on. Let's not try to, I want it to sound 90s-ish. I've never been into that.
So the remix projects, I wanted to delve into that for one second.
Sure,
like,
sure.
You're dealing with very well-known songs, whether it's like, you know, something from Common or, you know, ABC or My Sherry Amore or whatever.
Yeah. I never knew a la like this. Gotta be something for me to write this.
ABC.
How do you go about reinventing something where the audience is like hearing the original in their head sort of right alongside you?
Well, again, you know, I got to give a lot of credit to Beatnik because he's really a genius. But with it, to answer, I just felt like it's got to be as good as or better than the original version. And I know that's an arrogant statement, but if you've listened to any of those remixes, I've never heard anyone who's actually listened to them disagree with that statement. I just feel like, you know, it was our way of saying if we can make stuff as good as the original Michael Jackson songs or the original Steve, then someone's and it did more in Brazil, I feel like. And a lot of producers, a lot of these DJs, they play all of our remixes in clubs. And then I remember talking to, you know, talking to the promoters, like, yo, your DJs are playing like half of their set is our shit. Why don't you just like,
why don't you book us already?
Why don't you just book? Oh, no. So it's like, you know, that type of shit pisses me off. And then a lot of DJs will take it. And then when we put our name on there, they'll scrap it off. But anybody who's listened to those remixes knows those remixes are dope. Again, I don't feel like we got even close to the, I still see like these blog people that I know and they're like the best Michael Jackson remixes. And like, they won't put ours on. I'm like, if you don't put ours on and you've heard it, you don't know anything about music, period. Sorry.
No problem. And so you did that. You guys did that Smells Like Teen Spirit remix.
Yes.
Too, which is another, you know, taking we
didn't,
on
we didn't get
one.
We didn't get a lot of love for that. We did and we didn't, but we got, which was dope. We got death threats from Nirvana fans on that, which
really?
To me, yeah, which to me was showed that it was a success.
Wow.
Yeah.
People took it that serious.
People took it seriously. We got emails from people like, don't touch that Kurt's music. Who do you think you are? This and that. And I like that. I think that means that anytime you're creating people to get pissed off like that, to me as an artist, you're doing something right.
You guys put out this mixtape, The Streets Have No Name.
Yep.
Which was sort of a compilation of a lot of your work with, you know, maybe more mainstreamish rappers.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of songs with Young Buck on there.
Smallest nigga ball, these war grounds. You gotta watch where you're stepping. You step on other niggas' toes. You can die in a second. I've had my share. My reporter's a little boy, Halloween egg fight. Stealing niggas' cars, just trying to get my bread right. The big bugs bite every night, no water.
Was there going to be an album with him in the offing? What happened?
I don't know about an album, but we just ended up doing a lot of work with him. We did a lot of stuff on a lot of his mixtapes as well. You know, a lot of the mixtapes, they don't always credit the producer, but he didn't do that on purpose. Like, he's always been cool with us. He's always paid us. But we did a lot of work with Young Buck. We had a good, I feel like he's a dope writer. He's one of those dudes who doesn't try too hard. He doesn't try to get lyrical. He just tries to tell a story. I feel like he's really good at making an intro, coming to a climax, and then ending it off. I feel like he's one of the best at that. And we had a good relationship with G-Unit. You know, we did songs with 50. They never got released. But, you know, like I always say, he paid us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so tell me about that. How'd you first get in contact with G-Unit, and who'd you work with in the camp? There was obviously Buck and 50.
Shaw Money XL. I hustled and got his information from another person. I'll tell you what happened. This person was bragging about who he knew, and I told him, I don't believe that you know Shaw Money XL. And he showed his phone. Here's his number. And I did a mental picture of the phone number right there. And I hit him up, sent him beats, and that was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's funny. It seems like there was a period where G-Unit was working with pretty much any
dope
great
producer.
Yeah,
if you were a dope producer, you were in their loop. And a lot of that was because of Shaw Money. When he left, I had a real good relationship with this dude named Tony G. We're both Iranian, and we had a good relationship with him. And
Tony G was an A&R person and eventually the director of A&R at G-Unit Records.
You know, on the black, I don't like talking about this too much because it didn't happen. I don't like being like, this almost, because we have a lot of stuff that actually did happen. But on that Black Magic album 50 was going to do, we had a song where we sampled Screaming Jay Hawkins, I Put a Spell on You. That's been sampled a lot, actually, in hip hop, but we flipped it in a totally new way. And that was going to be the single to that album.
50 was prepping to release the Black Magic album in 2010. It was supposed to be a dance music influenced album and was mostly recorded while he was on the road in Europe. 50 eventually decided that, in his words, it doesn't make sense, and the album was shelved.
But, you know, it didn't happen, but it's all good.
Right. You mentioned Brazil a minute ago, and so how, Emicida, is that how you pronounce his name?
Emicida, yep.
Emicida, okay. How'd you hook up with him?
We hooked up with him, again, with that Mos Def SZA single. We put out a remix of it, I mean, instrumental, and it really took off. There was a DJ name, I believe his name was DJ Primo in Brazil. He passed away, and he was kind of like the gatekeeper of like hip-hop for Brazil. And he was a huge B-Nick and K-Salam fan. Mm. He played all of our stuff always. So a lot of those dudes in Brazil who were coming up in the early 2000s, they almost look at us as like their first experience with hip. You know, it's dope. It's a good feeling. But we put out that instrumental. That instrumental got a lot of love. It was like one of those songs. If you listen to it, it has a nice vibe to it that a lot of the DJs, not just Brazil, everywhere around the world, United States, everywhere. Young Buck actually did a song on that beat. In a lot of like freestyle cyphers, I remember in the late 90s, like around mid-late 90s, East Flatbush Projects, Tribe by 12. Is that mm-hmm. the song?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
No. That was like the song I remember.
That was a standard freestyle beat.
That was a standard freestyle beat. And so like in our beat in Brazil and other places as well, but it was more in the mixtape era. It wasn't so much a freestyle beat, but it was a beat that people would do songs over. Mm. And there was a lot of songs. And he did one, and we reached out to him, and he was already kind of getting a name at that time. But we definitely helped take him to the next level. He was like a street dude battling people, and he did a song over that beat. And we reached out to him, and he was like, I want to bring you to Brazil. I want to do a full album with you guys. Let's work out the money. Boom, that was it.
And that album actually has some of my favorite music of yours on it, actually.
Latinha, água de bica, sem caixa e torneira, deságua rica, lá da cachoeira, límpida. E os paralelepípedos a trepidar na madeira da roda das carroças, barulheira. Sombra de laranjeira aqui, mangueira, pé de caqui, caixa de feira e moleque.
Dope, thanks, man.
Yeah, that was great. So how would you describe the sound you were trying to go for with him? Was it kind of tailored to him, or did you just give him stuff that you would do anyway? Like, how would that work?
We kind of gave him stuff that we already had done, and we had a lot of stuff that wasn't being used, you know, and he just loved it. So he just did the songs. I felt like that was very natural. I remember me and Beatnik, at the time it came out, we were a little angry because it wasn't done in our minds. But I learned a lot from that. I learned sometimes they were looking at like Vice TV in Brazil, which is just as big as Vice is here. They wanted to put the song out on this, the album out on this date. And if we didn't put it out on that date, we would have missed that big cosign. And I realized sometimes you do actually have to, I can't talk right now. What's the word? You do have to kind of like compromise sometimes for promotion.
What wasn't done about it to you?
We wanted to put like more, it was going to be our first album that we produced for an artist all the way through. And it was a huge artist in Brazil at this time. We knew he was going to blow up. We knew that album was going to be like what it was. So we wanted to, you know, every little hook, every intro, scratches. What we wanted to put was the embellishments, scratches, guitar solos, keys, different solos, different cool stuff to kind of give it that final, you know, make it sound really full and like musical. And we didn't get to do any of that.
Right. So I think maybe, I don't know how much, how close in time it was to that, but you did an album with MERS, right? MERS and Fashan.
Yeah. Ow!
MERS. What up, though? Sean. K-Salam. Beatnik.
Yeah, that was definitely way after that.
That was way after, okay.
Yeah.
So that was, what was it like, you know, working with, so that was when Fashan was still pretty new.
Yeah, he was on the freshman top 10 list at that time.
Fashan was in the XXL freshman class of 2010. His album with MERS came out 2 years later in the fall of 2012.
So tell me about that record, because that had MERS, who even at that point had, you know, a long career behind him, and then a new rapper at the same time. So you have someone who doesn't really have an established sound, and then someone who has worked with, you know, Ninth Wonder and a ton of great producers through his career.
Yeah. That was fun, man. Like, it was kind of, it was easy. You know, I'd been talking to Murs for a while, and it just kind of came through naturally. And like, I'd been talking to Murs, and I forgot how I met Fashawn. I may have met him actually through Murs, and his manager, Aaron. That was just natural, man. It wasn't really a lot of work in the sense of like trying to put it together. Like, it just kind of came with my relationship. I had a relationship with Murs from back in the Rhyme Series days. So we kind
of that makes sense, of course. Yeah.
We always kept in contact, and we came back in contact through Rock the Bells. I DJed Rock the Bells a few years, and we started talking. And obviously, he does the Paid in Full booth, and I didn't even DJ that because of him. It was through this guy named Josh. I don't know if he's kind of one of those behind the scenes dudes. I don't like he likes people saying his name, but he manages Lauryn Hill now, Miss Lauryn Hill. And he's the one who kind of like put me on Rock the Bells. And
starting in 2007 and continuing for several years afterwards, the Rock the Bells Festival had a second stage presented by Paid Dues, the long-running hip-hop festival started by Murs. The Paid Dues independent hip-hop stage featured acts like Murs, MF Doom, Brother Ali, Mr. Lift, The Coup, and Hieroglyphics.
Yeah, it happened naturally, man. That was a dope album.
Yeah, it was. So was that Josh, the same person, Nameless Josh, the same person who got you hooked up with Lauryn Hill to work with her?
Yeah, him and another manager by the name of Angie. Yep.
Okay.
They both, yep.
Great. So tell me about that. You get this call, hey, we're interested in having you guys, you know, work with Lauryn. You know, what was the next step?
Well, that's something I pushed towards because I knew another one of her managers. And I was just kind of like, okay, you're working with Lauryn Hill now. You know, she's going to need producers. Like, come on. Like, you know what I'm saying? And I kind of pushed that. And then finally, like, they invited us to come through and play some stuff and vibe with her. And it went well. And it just happened really fast. It was like, okay, you want to be on the in-house production team and make sounds for her. She's going to have ideas. She's going to tell you. You guys make them, blah, blah, blah. It happened super, super fast. And it was like, it was a crazy experience because it was like full time. It was like 24/7. And we agreed to that. We agreed to that. But it was just, it's a lot because she's, you know, she's a big artist. Like, she's got a lot on her shoulders. And
yeah, the biggest, right? Like,
I mean, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So on the tour, when she was touring, you guys would help, or even I guess a part of your job was designing sounds for her, right?
Yeah, we designed sounds that her keyboard player would play on the tour. We designed sounds that the drummer would play through MIDI triggers. Mm-hmm. And that was our main thing. And then we did some other stuff on tour as well, helped out with some other stuff, some effects and whatnot. But that was our main reason of going on tour with her. And also we would make music with her on tour, like sometimes in her hotel room, sometimes just like wherever we could, we would be working on stuff. But that's the stuff, the music never came out. And just to be clear, you know, based off the deal that we made with her, it was produced by her. We were the in-house producers, like making the stuff that she would tell us, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But you know, none of that came out, which maybe it will one day, maybe not, but those sounds, you know, I heard those sounds every day when I went on tour. And that was really dope. I felt like that kind of put us in another place where, you know, we how many people can say that? You know what I'm saying? So that was fun, man. I had a good time.
Were you or Nick ever like, hey, I want to jump on stage and play the keyboards? I designed the sounds
Nick actually played bass on a couple shows.
Oh, okay.
And I would always jump on stage anyways and take pictures and just like chill and feel important. You know what I'm saying? That was fun. And she never cared. She always saw me walking around stage in the back and she was just like nodding to me like, all right. And my whole thing was I'm going on stage to listen to how the sounds sound, which I was, but I was also like feeling important.
But also it's a Lauryn Hill cool. show. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you get to stand behind the stage. Like, you're the man.
Like, that's amazing. You know what was it like to kind of take her ideas and make, you know, full-fledged songs out of them?
It was dope, man. You know, it was what it was. You know, I feel like me and Beatnik deserved to be in that position. I feel like we had been, and I still feel that way, but not in a bitter way, but I feel like we never really get the respect we deserve in hip hop, which is cool. because you know, we're making a living off of it. You can't really complain. So, but when we were working with her, it was kind of like, this is what we should be doing. We're at this talent level where we felt like we were at the top, and I still feel that way as far as talent wise and grind wise, and we should be working with, you know, Miss Lauryn Hill right now. So that's, yeah.
And so you had The Bluest Flame, your most recent album.
Yep.
With, you know, as K-Slam and Beatnik.
Yep.
And, you know, we talked a little bit last time about how it was made and how you would kind of direct the different guest artists and, you know, maybe give them,
mm-hmm.
some you'd give a topic, some, you know, you would give a hook and already composed stuff. You said your guy Adrian actually sings a bunch on it. Reason for the choice you're making. So who is Adrian?
Adrian's an artist. He signed a deal with Warner Brothers. He's from Tacoma, Washington. He sounds a little like Michael Jackson, not on purpose. That's his voice. Super talented guy, and the deal never happened. He does a lot of hooks with us. Living in New York state of mind, breathing the street life. His deal just fell through, you know, which happens all the time.
So how'd you end up in Vancouver?
I ended up in Vancouver. I forgot if I reached out to them or what happened, but I know I was, you know, looking at different teaching opportunities. I wanted to go somewhere that was still building their program, like kind of from the ground up. And that was a place that they had a one-year program. They wanted to turn it into a two-year. I saw an opportunity for me to help do that. It's a music technology program. And now I've been there for 2 years. I got my tenure, and I'm, you know, building the program. We got students from all over the world, some super talented people. I already got some of the people some looks with the Rhymesayer artist by the name of Nikki Jean. Some of my students helped produce some remixes and whatnot for her. It's cool in the shade, baby. These guys are dope, and they're doing, a lot of these students are doing some really cool stuff, and I can see a big future for them. A lot of people don't know. When I lived in New York, I was also teaching at the Institute of Audio Research. One of my students, Ed Riley, won a Grammy for his work with Snarky Puppy. Is it Snark Puppy? Or
Snarky Puppy.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a history. One of my students right now is working with Dave East. I have a history of, you know, I love teaching and bragging about, you know, my students doing big things, because they are. And some of it's because of me, some of it's not, but I still get to brag, you know.
And so what are you doing, anything on the production tip now yourself right now?
Yeah, me and Beatnik still doing stuff. We still have stuff coming out. We have a project coming out right now, not right now, but a project called I think I told you about it, the No Travel Band tape.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just different, and I'm not sure how we're going to market it, but it's definitely dope. It's not like one full song. It's literally like little snippets all melded together, and some kind of using my mixtape structuring skills. And then there's a lot of cool stuff, a lot of cool experimental stuff going on in there. And it's really dope. That's the main thing. But we still have a lot of stuff going on. We still a lot of placements coming up. I can't really say, but we still
of
got
course.
Placements.
Do you, even though you're living in two different places now, do you still sort of send music back and forth or still create new things? Or are you kind of going on your catalog of stuff?
No, we still create new things. You know, a lot of times, you know, man, it's a good question, dude. We have such a huge catalog.
I was going to say, I'm sure by now you have tons of stuff that hasn't been used.
A lot of times what will happen is I'll go back in our catalog and look at stuff that we could maybe update. And then because Nick's not as involved, on the hands-on side, but he'll tell me, okay, I like the way you updated this, but maybe let's put like a 808 snare instead of this and whatnot. And usually I'll listen to them because, you know, you have to know your strengths and weaknesses. You know, I really look at me and Nick as like Pippin and Jordan, and he's Jordan. I'm not going to lie. He's Jordan, but I love Pippin. Pippin was my favorite basketball player ever. So, you know, I like being the Scottie Pippin of the, I know that's arrogant, but whatever.
And I think I remember talking to you. You said you were trying to get maybe more back into DJing, back into turntablism. Is that?
It's not so much I'm getting back into it. I've always done it. But recently in Vancouver, you know, being that I'm making a living teaching, I'm not really stressed out about making money anymore. Which is that's why I say when I said that we're underrated, it's not to whine, because I'm very lucky in this time to be in that position. There's, you know, my family's immigrants, there's people being stripped at the border. There's nothing I have to complain about at all. So I'm in a great, very good position that I don't have to worry about money as much, you know? So I really got back into turntablism because I'm like, when I started it, it was out of the love. It was kind of, I was going through certain things and it was a way to get my ideas out, and I was good at it. And that's, I started really, really doing it again. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to put some video of this and yeah, we're going to put some video out and just let people know that I got skills. And I not that many people on the turntablism and the production end, I don't know, not that many people out there can step up to that, man. There's some dope turntablists out there, some dope producers, but like the duo of both, I don't know.
Nice. And if you had to pick from your entire catalog of say stuff that people can hear right now, like stuff that has been released, what are some of your favorite Beatnik and K-Salam songs?
I like the Freddie Gibbs Anything to Survive record.
Killing my own, flipping pitch in the stone. Niggas gon' listen cause I'm living this shit in my song. If I should die before I wait, just know some busters ran up in my spot and shot me in my face cause I'm a motherfucking gangster. And I move through
the
day. Why? It's just dope. Really,
I was
dope.
Listening on the way over here, actually. Yeah, that's a great one.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks. I really feel like that's an underground classic song. And a lot of people tell me that, like, yo, you did that, and yeah, I mess with that. And, you know, it's a song, it's not like a huge pop number one record, but I feel like that's just one of those dope hip-hop records that I can listen to anytime and be like, damn. What else? I like the last album we did. I really like the last album we did a lot. I like the songs we did with Quali a lot. I like on the last album. Yeah.
Come on. Walking with my head high, and everybody keep their hands up. Yeah, glitch in the matrix. The shit need a facelift, consistent with the wisdom of the ages. Shit is so contagious, maybe cause the spit is so amazing. When shot me rewinds, so the pistol ablazing. Dead on arrival, nobody safe, man.
Man, I like a lot of the stuff that we done, you know? I don't listen to a lot of our music, though, and I know Beatnik's the same. I think a lot of musicians will tell you that. They don't really listen to their own stuff all that much. But, like, what is really cool is if I'm, you know, haven't listened to something in a long time, and then I'm in a coffee shop or something, like, and then one of our songs will come on, and I'll be like, "Oh, this is really good," you know, and that's kind of a good feeling. But it's hard to say what some of the. I think we did a song with Papoose and Busy Signal that was like a little mixtape banger. Didn't really do all that much again, you know, but check out that song. That song is great.
We generate the same money in a time span as America, Russia, China, Canada, Japan. We can own our own banks, but we get devoured because we don't unite.
Nice. And will we hear you in the 20? We got you in the 2016 Olympics, you and an Emicida song.
Yep.
Emicida's track Levanta e Anda,
produced by Beatnik and K-Salam, was used in NBC's opening montage for the 2016 Olympics in Rio.
2020 Olympics, maybe?
No comment.
Awesome. And what else do you want people to know about what K-Salam and Beatnik have going on?
I feel like I said it all. You know, if you are trying to learn how to be a music producer, I do teach a class. If you live in the United States, you might want to come to NYU, Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. I teach a class there every summer. And even though it's a short class, the students leave and they love it. I've gotten a lot. Students still reach out to me, telling me how much they appreciate the class. If you live in Canada, you know, I teach at the Douglas College at Music Technology, and it's a 2-year program. So it's not just hip hop stuff. We got heavy metal kids in there. I teach how to record microphones and how to mix, master the whole shebang. And, you know, so if you want to learn, come sign up. What else?
Has that been important for you to know how to do everything, how to mix, how to set up mics?
I learned that from Nick. Yeah, I learned that because I was just like, this kid does everything. And when I went and I wanted to learn that. So And when I was really into DJing, it was very important for me to know how to rock a party, not just scratch. Because there's scratch DJs that can't rock a party for nothing. I want to know how to rock a party. Also rock different types of parties, you know, different types of crowds, different types of music, how to scratch with both hands, how to do the old school scratches and the new stuff. So I kind of took that ideology into the production side. I want to be able to do everything. So that's something I got to give a lot of credit to Beatnik. Like I learned a lot being around, just being around him. Really talented dude. He doesn't do the interviews, you know. It's my job to like let people know that he's the Michael Jordan of this music shit.
Sounds like a great place to end. K Salam, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
One of the things that was so notable about K Salam when I first got to know him was how many songs I loved that he had produced. His catalog is very extensive, far more so, as he points out, than he normally gets credit for. So I feel very fortunate to have given him a chance to recount his history. I was reminded of this when I saw K Salam at the Soundset Festival. He talked to everyone from Young M.A. to Drew Ha to Bun B with the same ease and familiarity. It was a measure of how much he's accomplished, but also a measure of the kind of person he is. I think this interview is also notable for its honesty about the ups and downs that go along with any kind of artistic career, and about how the roles within artistic partnerships can shift and change over time. Join us in 2 weeks when our guests will be Crisis and Elzai, a producer and rapper team who have banded together to become the group Jericho Jackson. You'll hear all about why they decided to team up and what makes their partnership work. As I said at the beginning, the best way to keep the show going is to give us some cash at patreon.com/thecyphershow. After you're done with that, go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. This is what helps us keep doing the show. You do want us to keep doing it, right? You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Cypher Show. And don't forget, more information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
I wasn't really doing all that much with my life, too, to be honest, and I was smoking a lot of weed.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
This guy named Josh, I don't know if he's kind of one of those behind-the-scenes dudes. I don't like people saying his name.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
From a small town in northern Minnesota.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Even though he's 10 years younger than me, he taught me a lot about music production.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I was really smoking a lot of weed.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Gabe Patterson.
You do have to kind of compromise sometimes for promotion.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Was it too arrogant, man?
No, that's great.